Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
Depression thrives in secrecy, but it shrinks in empathy. And the more we can talk about it, the more we can open up and empathize with each other, the better off that we'll all be.
Welcome to a new episode of Measuring Success Right. I am Cecily Henstrom.
And I'm Andrea Cabrera.
And we are thrilled to welcome our guest today, Jane Clayson Johnson.
Very excited. So the reason why Cecily and I are excited is because she, Jane, is involved in journalism, communications. She's had a lot of awesome background. Cecily and I are both journalists at BYU, so we're very excited to touch base about that. We want to talk a little bit about her bio. That's something really important for our listeners to know. Jane Clayson Johnson is an award-winning journalist widely known for her work at CBS News, ABC News, and on the nationally syndicated NPR program On Point. Jane is the best-selling author of I Am a Mother, which chronicles her decision to leave the world and network news to have a family.
In 2018, Jane also published Silent Souls Weeping, exploring the stigma of depression in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to teach, as she writes, that no one is alone in this struggle. Jane and her husband, Mark, live in Boston. They are parents of 5 children and grandparents of 3. Welcome, Jane. We are so delighted to have you here today.
Oh, thank you, guys. It's really nice to be with you. I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
No, thank you. We want to start this interview, this conversation, by talking about, like we mentioned earlier, we're both journalism students. We know that a lot of like broadcasting and talent on air, you know, we watch some videos and some of your on-air work, and you're amazing. You're a very talented and professional person. And I mean, sometimes as a student, you know, I just had my reporting class. Cecily's just in a reporting class now. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is hard.
It's very hard.
This is hard. Like, I want to know, has it always been natural for you?
Oh, well, you know, I have had an incredible ride in journalism, and I will always be grateful for the experiences that I had over many years, almost, 15, 18 years in television, in local news at KSL in Salt Lake City, and then, as you said, at ABC News, based in Los Angeles, at CBS News in New York, and now filling in on the NPR program in Boston.
Wow.
So, you know, it all started at BYU, and I do remember that reporting class.
Oh, my goodness.
It was so much fun and a lot of work and a lot to learn. I always felt like journalism was a calling for me. I felt like I always wanted to be sort of a conduit between the story, between what was happening in the world and those people who didn't have the extraordinary opportunity to be in the middle of it, like I found myself. And so it was a real honor and a privilege, and I took it very seriously. And, you know, I started my days at BYU as a music major. I went to college on a scholarship, on a violin scholarship. I played my whole life and always loved to write, and found myself introduced to the newsroom through a professor there, and just the world opened up to me, and I fell in love, and I never looked back.
Wow, I love that.
When you were in our place as a student, how did you envision your future? You mentioned you liked writing a lot, but did you know that being a mother and author would be a part of that picture?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I never planned to have the career that I have. You know, I came to BYU and I didn't know my future. I thought perhaps I would be married and you know, there were lots of things that I thought I might do, but I never in a million years anticipated that my life would take the turn that it did into television. And so, you know, when I made the decision after many years in television to leave my career to be a mother and mm-hmm. to move to Boston from New York, where I had been anchoring the early show on CBS mm-hmm, with Brian yeah. Gumbel for several years, and getting up at 3:30 in the morning and just having an incredible opportunity to interview, you know, the biggest newsmakers of the day, you know, Secretary yeah. of State one minute and Martha Stewart the next, and, you know, actors and just an incredible breadth of experience. And so when I decided to leave CBS to move to Boston, get married at the age of 37, I felt like it was a turning point for me. Wow. I felt like it was a new season that I was starting. And so, you know, those days as an 18, 19-year-old freshman at BYU seemed like a lifetime away. And yet I'm so grateful for all the experiences that I've had, because they've really shaped me in mm-hmm. ways that I never could have imagined.
The thing I love about this is just being able to hear all those stories and, you know, the thoughts that were going through your head. A lot of the times when we see all these professionals, we always see their success, right? We see their triumph, their achievements. And I love to hear about how you got to that. Something you said that really stood out to me was the fact that you called it a calling. You said you mm-hmm. felt something. And I'm wondering, what made you realize that this was a calling, and what did you feel like that calling was?
Well, I felt like it was an enormous responsibility. You know, and I was sitting across from, you know, a military general or a world leader or,
oh, wow.
You know, the Secretary of State or, you know, the soon-to-be president the night before the inauguration. You know, those are big. Those are big moments, and those are important moments where you try to, you know, inform people and help people understand sort of the nature of what's happening in the news, in government,
wow.
In education, in, you know, so many different areas in international and world affairs. So I felt like I always took it, you know, very seriously. And to be honest, the media landscape has changed so much just in the last 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years. It's different. It feels different to me now. There's a polarization now that didn't exist when I started and was working in network television. And it saddens me. And it's difficult to watch, actually, because I think the quality of journalism in many ways is different, has changed.
Definitely.
And so the calling for me was always, I just felt like I needed it always to do my best. I learned mm-hmm. that at BYU. I remember taking my stories in reporting classes to mm-hmm. the teacher after class and saying, you know, tell me how this can be better. Tell me how the lead could be better. How this could be better written. How this could be edited better. And I just
right.
always felt like I could do better and do more and sort of make it shine a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so pushing myself in that way all the way along from my days at BYU and then it's certainly at network level, which was a totally different and very demanding
right.
Experience, you know, was, I think, a lesson, an important lesson for everyone who's starting out to understand.
That's so amazing to me, because everything that you're saying is kind of the same reasons that I'm interested in journalism. But I want to talk about for a second, you moved from this calling, this responsibility, and this focus on network broadcasting, and you decided to step down from that and step back and become a mother. Can you talk a little bit about that experience for you and what the biggest challenge was leaving network television and how different it was to take on the role of being a mother?
Mm-hmm. Well, after spending a lot of time driving pretty hard over the course of several years in network television, I mean, at ABC, I was gone traveling much of the time. I'd say probably 80 to 90% of the time I was on the road, whether it was covering the fall of the Suharto government in Indonesia,
wow.
whether
mm-hmm.
it was, covering the NATO airstrikes mm-hmm. in Macedonia mm-hmm. and the in Kosovo and the refugee crisis in Macedonia.
Right.
I've covered a 747 crash in Guam and all sorts of international stories that had me traveling quite a bit. I covered the O.J. Simpson trial. You guys are too young to remember, but that was a big deal, you know,
wow.
back in those days. And
mm-hmm.
and it was a lot. And then I got to New York and you know, getting up every morning so early and just running faster and faster
and
one interview after the next and then, you know, coming home and studying for hours to prepare for the next day, you know, it was a lot of work and I loved it. But I realized that there was a part of my life that I had been missing and that I wanted to have more balance in my life, and I wanted to be able to experience that particular season, which was a family. And so I made that decision, and I didn't make it lightly. I mean, there was a lot of pressure for me not to leave. I remember my agent said to me, you know, you're making a terrible mistake. You know, what are you going to do? Move to Boston and teach Sunday school? You know, how are you going to fill your time? What are you going to do with yourself? And,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people told me that it was a bad decision, because once you step off the train in a network news, it's very hard to get back on.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. Yeah. And, you know, it was a decision that I made that was important to me. And I, you know, people make decisions about very personal things based on their own circumstance and their own desires. So I
Definitely.
Don't have any judgment for other people who make different decisions for different reasons. But for me, this was the right thing to do. And so I did. I left New York and I moved to Boston and mm-hmm. I had two children in 2.5 years. And
wow.
You know, and my life changed. And I had the opportunity then to do a little part-time work at the NPR station in Boston, and it just kind of all worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was grateful for the courage that it took, and being encouraged by people to follow my heart, because that's what my heart
Beautiful.
Was telling me to do, and it was a hard
mm-hmm.
decision, but I did it, and I'm glad that I did it, and it wasn't easy.
Right.
It wasn't easy.
No, right,
but
right.
But it was the right decision for me.
Yeah. And I'm sure you made this decision. And here's a little thing. When I was trying to stalk you before this interview, I found a video from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a video that says a mother, journalist, and a Mormon. And the video starts off by highlighting, you know, I think it's you. It's a sound clip, a sound bite of you saying, I found myself picking up Cheerios and Oreos, and I found myself doing all these things, and I thought to myself, you know, as a mother, and I thought to myself, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? And I'm sure, you know, these decisions, you're following your heart, but like you said, they're not easy. And
right.
when you made that transition, like I mentioned in the video, like you had these thoughts of, oh my gosh, like this is not easy, but what kept you going?
Well, I knew what I was doing was important. And so I didn't, you know, it was different from what I had done before, but no less important, and probably, well, definitely more important. And while,
right.
you know, society often does not acknowledge or recognize or value the work of parenting, you know, the work that we do as mothers and fathers is the most important work that we will ever do. And so, you know, sure, I had an incredible career, and I had valuable experiences and wonderful experiences and fun experiences, but this was a different kind of experience, and it was a different season of my life. And so, you know, I didn't want anybody ever telling me to stay in one season because they believed that I should be there or not move on to another season. And so, you know, I had some support. It was lonely at times, to be perfectly honest, and it wasn't easy
mm-hmm.
because we get validated at work in a different way and sort of more readily than we do with parenting. And so I looked at different opportunities to have different outlets and felt supported by people around me. I wrote a book and then wrote another book. And, you know, there are ways that we feel that we've made the right choice in our life. And I think when you feel that and you know that, it doesn't matter what anybody else says about your choice.
Oh yeah.
You can feel at peace with what you've decided.
Thank you for your thoughts. It's really interesting hearing about these things. And I'm sure we could talk about your experience as a mother forever. I mean, you, like you said, you did write a book about it. There's so much to talk about there. I'd like to talk a little bit about your more recent book as well, Silent Souls Weeping, and just ask you, what was your biggest challenge in approaching the subject of depression? Because that's a very sensitive, and as you talk about in your book, stigmatized subject. So what was your greatest challenge with that, with reaching out with to people to interview and learning about the subject as well?
So I had a difficult experience with depression a few years ago, several years after I had my first child, and it took me down. It took me to a place I'd never been before, very dark and desperate and difficult place, and it was physiological. I mean, there was a chemical change that had been happening in my brain, and you know, there are lots of different causes for depression, and everyone experiences it differently. But for me, it was so damaging, and it just felt like I couldn't go on. And you know, it got so bad that I was starting to think that, you know, my husband would be so much better off with a different wife, and my children deserved, you know, a different mother, a better mother. And my husband finally sort of stepped in and took over and took me to get some help. And I did, and I came out of it, and I recovered with medication and for a time, and therapy and all sorts of things, but it was just a devastating experience. And so I thought, you know, as I started opening up about it and people were sharing their experiences with me, I thought, this is so widespread. And so I thought, why don't I take my journalism skills and use it to shine a light on the problem of depression? And so I did that, and I spent 3 years interviewing more than 150 people, all members of our church all across the country, all suffered or are suffering with depression and mental illness. And by the end of it, I had thousands of pages of transcripts over 3 years, you can imagine, right, in a massive iCloud file. And I just essentially drew a line through what I was hearing and wrote chapters around that. So I talked about postpartum depression. I talked about missionaries who come home early from their missions because of mental illness. I talk about suicide. I talk about toxic perfectionism as a contributor to depression. And I guess the bottom line is that so many people feel such stigma surrounding mental illness. And my goal was to engage an important conversation within our faith community about mental health, to take these conversations from a whisper to a song, to not be afraid to talk about it, because I have learned that depression thrives in secrecy, but it shrinks in empathy. And the more we can talk about it, the more we can open up and empathize with each other, the better off that we'll all be.
That Cecil and I just looked at each other, and that was just beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. We also saw that, you know, with this whole topic of depression and turning it from a whisper to a song, and we saw that you took a recent trip to India and you worked with people that have leprosy.
Yeah.
Can you please tell us a little more about that?
Yeah. So we took our children to India a couple of years ago to work with an incredible organization called Rising Star. And they take volunteers into the leprosy colonies, and they provide services for them. And those children from the colonies who do not have leprosy themselves are taken and educated, and they're lifted up out of these terrible circumstances. So we took our two 12 and 10-year-old children at the time with us, and it was just an extraordinary experience. And I wrote about it in my book to say that, you know, mental health, I likened it to the experience of leprosy. You know, when people have leprosy, they're literally falling apart. Their skin is falling off. They have limbs that are degenerating. And, you know, it's a terrible illness. And I say that, you know, mental illness needs to be like that, where we can just talk about it, where we can say, you know, I'm falling apart. There's something not right in my brain. Yeah. And that we can be open about it, that we don't have to feel the stigma attached to it. There is such stigma with leprosy in India, and there's such stigma with mental health issues often in the United States. And so I just liken the two to say, you know, we need to be able to sort of throw open the doors and the windows and shine some light on this terrible affliction that's really impacting so many people. You know, stigma continues to be the leading reason that people don't reach out for help, even in times of crisis, when they have a mental health struggle. And I'm very open to say that depression is not the result of some sort of personal inadequacy, right? It's not a black mark on your character. It's not your fault. If you had cancer or heart disease or any other serious illness, you would never say, oh, I'm just going to pull myself up by my bootstraps and tackle this liver cancer alone, you know? No, you go to the doctor, you go to, you know, you take medication, you do whatever you had to do. You know, you're not going to fix depression with work and discipline. It's like any other physical condition, and it requires treatment.
I really like that comparison with the leprosy, because I think it helps teach in a very imaginable way the way that depression is affecting people. I think one of the great things about this podcast and this opportunity to talk to you is everybody has such a different life. And, you know, you've had so many different endeavors in your life with broadcast, motherhood, your books. And I just wanted to ask you if you consider yourself a successful person. And if you do or you do not, what does success look like to you?
Well, I think success to me is being at peace with the decisions that I have made. It is being open to new experiences, and it is feeling love with those around you and those that are closest to you, and then reaching out to extend that love to others. So we're all hoping to reach, you know, success, whatever that is. But to me, those are the three elements of success. And I try every day to reach a point where I feel like I'm successful in those areas. Those are intangibles, right? Mm-hmm. You can't put a price tag. You can't write a contract and, you know, fulfill that with an employer. You can't. These are things to me that are the most important, but they're also the hardest. And so every day I strive to feel peace, to extend love, and to just try to make the world a better place. And if I have done that, then in some measure I am successful.
I like that. I like the analogy of thinking about success from a day-to-day basis, right? And thinking of those little moments. We've mentioned it before in some other episodes too, where success is an ongoing pursuit. It's not a one-in-a-lifetime event. It's a day-to-day thing, and that goes hand-in-hand with what you just said, and I really, really like that a lot. This podcast is to be able to connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today, and to know how to give aid to those young professionals who are trying to live those successful lives, right? Who, whatever their personal definition of success may be, I'm wondering how you think the leaders of tomorrow, those future leaders, can prepare today to be successful?
Well, I think first and foremost, you have to follow your heart. You have to follow what feels right to you. And what feels right to you and what is right for you is going to be different than someone else's right, you know. And so you have to have the courage to be able to stand up for what you know to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing I feel like I have done in my career and in my life, it is that. And I can say it wasn't always easy, but I think it's the most important principle that I learned really from my parents, you know, to make the right choice and to follow that choice no matter where it leads.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the first thing. And I think the second thing I'll steal from my husband, who is just will just be publishing a book from Harvard Business Press next month called Lead from the Future. And he talks a lot about envisioning the future and then walking back to the present. So making decisions based on forward-looking, having a goal in your mind, and then walking back to do what you need to do to get there. And I think that that's really a really important thing for young people starting out, to kind of have goals and to look forward reach high and then kind of walk it back and see what you need to do to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not going to happen just, you know, by whistling it and, you know, having it run toward you. You have to go get it sometimes.
Right,
you know? So that's what I would say. That's how I would answer that question.
Thank you. That's a great answer. And congratulations to your husband on his book.
Yeah.
Send him that.
Sounds very interesting.
From us.
Mm-hmm.
We like that thought a lot. We're going to close out here, and we want to end with giving you a scenario and then asking you a question. So imagine you're out getting hot chocolate with a young professional, and it's 2:59 and your parking meter is about to go out and you've got to go. But you have the chance to give them one more message before you go. What would be the message that you would want to leave with them and to leave with us and our listeners?
What I would say, if I had one last second before I had to leave, I would tell that young person to always follow your heart, to always make good choices, even though those choices may be different from the people around you. I think it's so easy for us and for young people to kind of have a herd mentality and to kind of go with the crowd. And I would say to that young person, do what's right and follow your heart, but make good choices. And as I said in my previous answer, those choices will always lead you to the right place because you have done it from a place of good motivation. So it's got to be follow your heart. It's got to be do what's right and make good choices.
Mm-hmm.
And don't follow the crowd. Follow your heart.
Thank you. Jane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks, you guys. I appreciate the time, and I wish you both good luck in your careers and in your studies. Work hard.
Thank you. We will. We want to thank our listeners for joining us today on our episode with Jane Clayson-Johnson. And we want to thank her for also taking the time to talk to us, young professionals, those future leaders of tomorrow. This is Andrea Cabrera.
And Cecily Henstrom.
With Measuring Success Right. We hope you have a wonderful week.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.